for listening to Central Time. I'm Dean Knetter in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, a citywide program in Madison lets paramedics and mental health workers respond to some of the city's mental health emergency calls. We talked to Madison's mayor about the program and the impact of having an option that doesn't require law enforcement. Now, Wisconsin and Minnesota have long had a battle over which state has more lakes. Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources says our state has just over 15,000 lakes, while Minnesota's DNR says its state has just under 12,000. But it turns out each state uses different definitions of what bodies of water are big enough to count as a lake. There's no universally accepted standard for what classifies as a lake or a pond. That can cause problems in the water in the world of freshwater ecology. A group of researchers set out to develop that standard, and they're out with a project that can help us start sorting out lakes, ponds, and wetlands. Meredith Holgerson is an assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Cornell University. She's a freshwater ecologist and a lead co-author on the research published in Scientific Reports. Meredith, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to start first with the why. Why is it important for us to have these actual definitions for lakes, ponds, and wetlands?
Well, you set up a really fun example sharing the debate between Wisconsin and Minnesota who has more lakes. Now, this is a lighthearted feud among states, but it does have more serious implications. The lack of a universal definition can create a lot of headaches and confusion. It relates to the scientific study of these water bodies, making sure scientists are speaking the same language, but it also affects things like what water bodies get monitored at a state or federal level, how are they protected, and how are they managed. Ponds currently fall through the cracks. They're often excluded from or underrepresented in monitoring efforts. And this may in part stem from really unclear definitions.
And how did you go about starting to look into how ponds and lakes have been defined before and how they should be defined going forward?
Yeah, so we started talking about this because we were realizing that in the literature, in the scientific literature, there wasn't a really clear definition for what a pond is versus what a lake is. And I've been studying ponds for over a decade, and a common question I get from friends and family is, well, what is a pond and how is it different from lakes? So we decided to start by diving into the scientific literature. We reviewed over 500 papers that had ponds in them to see if they define ponds. We were only able to find 54 definitions, and most of those were really vague, really qualitative. Many of them use the word small and shallow, but don't define how small or how shallow. And none of them were based off of scientific evidence. For instance, there was no study that said a 1 acre pond is different than a 10 acre or 100 acre lake functionally based off of how these ecosystems are working. So we decided to examine those existing definitions, also examine legislation. Where do states place ponds? Do they place them with lakes? Do they place them with wetlands? Do they have a pond definition? And then really dive into the functional characteristics of lakes, ponds, and wetlands and see how, if and how they are different from each other.
That was a really interesting part of your research, is that it wasn't just about the size or volume of a body of water. It was about how it actually works and functions. Can you talk about how the ecosystem of a pond is unique from anything else?
Yeah, so we decided to take values from the literature on metrics of ecosystem function. So you can think about ecosystem functions, things like how much phosphorus or nitrogen is in the water body, how productive it is, how much algae is there, how much methane is coming off of the system, how fast can gases exchange with the atmosphere. So all of these different metrics of how the ecosystem functions. And then we looked at that relationship between those ecosystem functions and characteristics that are showing up in the definitions. So surface area, depth, emergent vegetation coverage. And if we saw no relationship between those characteristics, those functions of the ecosystem, and say surface area, then there really doesn't need to be a definition of what a pond is versus what a lake is, because they just function the same. But what we found is that for all of the metrics that we looked at, for the surface area, for depth, for vegetation, we mostly saw really non-linear relationships with those ecosystem functions. So ponds that are small or shallow, they have either really high rates of these ecosystem functions or lower rates than what a lake does. So that suggests there's these threshold changes at which a system is more pond-like or more lake-like or more wetland-like. And so we were able to use those thresholds to inform a definition to say how small a system has to be a pond.
And one of those examples you mentioned was emergent vegetation. Can you tell us briefly what that is exactly and how we see it work in a pond?
Yeah, so if you were to give a picture of a wetland that has a lot of plants coming out of the water and a picture of a lake that has a lot of open water, you're going to visually see that that's distinctive. And people will usually say a wetland has more of that emergent vegetation coming out of it, and a lake has more of that open water and might only have the vegetation on the edges. And so unfortunately, there's not great data on the emergent vegetation coverage for lots and lots of lakes, ponds, and wetlands for our analysis. So we need more information on that. But we did see there were threshold changes when you look at that emergent vegetation coverage. So as you get more wetland-like versus more open water body-like, the systems are functioning differently.
And putting together those ecosystem functions and the sizes of these bodies of water, were you able to come up with a definition of sorts for pond, lake, wetland?
Yes, we were. We were not sure if we would feel really good about the numbers, and we were excited that the numbers sort of converged and also match up with some the kind of the order of magnitude from some previous research. So we say that ponds are less than 5 hectares in size and less than 5 meters in depth. So the 5 and 5 rule, that's 12 acres and 16 feet for those of us thinking more in standards in the United States. And then less than 30% emergent vegetation coverage.
And so anything bigger than that would classify as perhaps a lake, or I'd imagine the more vegetation, a wetland?
Yes, exactly.
And as you mentioned in your research, this is just a starting point, but an important one. What additional research are you hoping to see into how we label our bodies of water?
I think we need more research around those boundaries. So looking at systems that are around 5 hectares or 5 meters deep and seeing if in different landscapes or in different elevations, different sheltering, like trees that can reduce wind speeds on water bodies. Do we see these numbers? Is it a gray area? What are those transitions like? I think this is going to end up being really important to inform the policy and inform the monitoring strategies for ponds.
Well, Meredith, thank you for joining us and sharing your research today.
Thanks for having me.
Meredith Holgerson is an assistant professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at Cornell University. She's the lead co-author on a research published in Scientific Reports that sets new definitions for lakes, ponds, and wetlands. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with the controversial history surrounding the ice cream sundae.
Wisconsin is the home to many firsts. The first blender, the first typewriter, and even malted milk was developed and introduced to the world right here in the Dairy State. Two Rivers is the home of the first ever ice cream sundae. Well, that last one is debated by some. Dean Robbins explains.
I like driving across Wisconsin to see legendary historical sites. I've planned whole trips around the Eau Claire baseball field where Hank Aaron got his start, and the Janesville house where Abraham Lincoln spent the night. But every once in a while, I stumble across a bit of Wisconsin history I knew nothing about. That happened on a recent drive through the northeast part of the state when I pulled into Two Rivers. In Central Park, I noticed an official Wisconsin historical marker claiming it as the birthplace of the ice cream sundae, coincidentally my favorite dessert. Could such a major phenomenon have originated in this small town? According to the marker, a local man named George Hallauer walked into a soda fountain on 15th Street in 1881. He asked owner Edward Berner to top a dish of ice cream with chocolate sauce, a substance previously reserved for ice cream sodas. The new concoction caught on, and Berner began selling it for a nickel, but only on Sundays. Enter a 10-year-old girl who insisted on having a dish of ice cream with that stuff on top on a different day of the week. That was out of the question for Berner, until the girl charmingly suggested that they pretend it was Sunday. That opened the floodgates, with the shopkeeper offering the dish every day in many flavors. The unusual spelling of Sunday started when a salesman placed an order for Berner's canoe-shaped dishes with his glassware company. He requested Sunday dishes with an E at the end rather than a Y, and the rest is history. Or so says the state of Wisconsin. Is this amazing story for real? Standing there in Central Park, I searched for ice cream Sunday origin on my phone. Sure enough, Two Rivers has rivals to the claim. The most aggressive challenger is Ithaca, New York, which points to a 19th century newspaper ad for a locally served Sunday. In a New York Times article on the dispute, Ithaca's mayor sneered at Two Rivers, saying, "We have the historical documents, and they don't." Two Rivers refused to take that lying down. The city passed a resolution demanding that Ithaca cease and desist with its Sunday slanders. Residents also deluged Ithaca's mayor with postcards picturing the Wisconsin historical marker. On matters of milk fat, Ithaca surely learned that you crossed the dairy state at your peril. So what's the truth? To gather crucial evidence, I strolled to the Two Rivers Visitor Center in an 1850s inn. You can bet the complex houses a soda fountain, named after local hero Edward Berner. Purely for the sake of historical research, I ordered an ice cream sundae. Was it a descendant of the world's first sundae, served here in 1881? Sorry, Ithaca, but I have no documentation. All I'll say is that, with its thick chocolate sauce, overflowing whipped cream, and juicy cherry, the dish made me a believer.
Dean Robbins is a journalist and author based in Madison. He's won state and national awards for arts, features, and news stories, and has contributed to magazines and newspapers around the country. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television, in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Coming up, Madison's mayor joins the show to talk about the city's effort to find new ways to respond to emergency mental health calls that don't involve uniformed police officers. That's next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Knetter, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up at 6 on 1A+, another January 6th hearing is in the books. What new information do we know about the plans to attack the Capitol and the ties between domestic extremists and the White House? That's coming up at 6 on 1A+. Now, the city of Madison launched an effort last year to provide some emergency mental health calls with non-law enforcement responders. The project is called the Community Alternative Response Emergency Services, or CARES for short. It means that instead of police, 911 calls for nonviolent mental health emergencies are answered by a two-person team, a fire department paramedic and a mental health crisis worker. The program started taking calls citywide this spring and is coming up on a year in operation. We're checking in on how it's going and what impact the CARES program is having on the community. Satya Rhodes-Conway is the mayor of Madison. Mayor Rhodes-Conway, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dean. It's a pleasure to be here as always.
What were you seeing and others in the city seeing that led you to want to start this program?
Oh, you know, we felt like it was really important for folks who are, you know, having a mental health or a behavioral health crisis, but not a threat to others or to the community, to be connected with care instead of, you know, connecting with a police officer. And we also wanted to free up our officers' time to deal with, you know, more serious issues around public safety. So it was important for us to think about what is really the best response when somebody is in this kind of crisis, and let's provide that instead of just defaulting to it being a police response.
And as you were developing the program, were there other cities where this was in place and getting going that you looked to for some inspiration or information?
Yeah, so we always like to learn from other cities that might be doing something that's interesting or innovative. And so in this case, we looked to Eugene, Oregon, and to Denver, Colorado in particular, but also a few other places that are doing something similar.
As we mentioned, these responses go toward nonviolent emergencies. Can you give us an example? What are some of the types of calls and situations that responders are going to?
So it can be a whole range, and the calls, may come in from into the 911 center, and it may be that the operator is listening and saying, "Okay, I think this is a CARES call." It can be somebody who calls in and specifically asks for the service. So it might be somebody who, you see somebody on the street, they don't look quite right. They look like they're having some sort of mental health episode. It may be, something where it's a family member or a friend, and you know that they have outstanding issues and you need some support. I mean, it really is kind of across the board, the calls that come in to the CARES team and get dispatched, right? So it does go through the dispatch center, through the 911 center, and they are trained to send a set of different call types to the CARES team instead of sending them to either police or fire.
And so if a loved one is having a mental health crisis, you can request a CARES response, but even if you don't know about the program necessarily, dispatch will perhaps funnel it toward that.
Yes, that's right.
Gotcha. And can you talk about the goals of the CARES team, that duo of people, when they show up to a call? What are their first steps? What are they really trying to do there?
So our overarching goal here is to connect people with the care that they need and to treat mental and behavioral health issues through a public health or a healthcare lens. So our CARES teams will go out, they'll assess the situation, they'll de-escalate if they need to, it may be appropriate for them to provide some treatment right there. It may be appropriate for them to, make a connection or a recommendation to further resources in the community, or it may be appropriate for them to actually transport somebody to a treatment situation. They have a lot of options of what they can do, but it starts with getting to the scene, assessing the situation, de-escalating the situation, and really connecting with the person who needs help and support, and finding out what kind of help and support specifically they're going to need, and then what we can offer them.
And the program has been going for about a year now. I know it expanded from the downtown area in Madison to a citywide program now. How has it been going? Has it been put to use?
Absolutely. So we started in September of 2021. And as you said, we started only in the Central District. Right now, we're only operating Monday through Friday in the sort of midday shift, because when we started the program, we actually looked back at these types of calls and when they were most frequent. And that's when we had the highest call volume. So we wanted to meet the need, first of all. But as of June 30th, we've had a total of 615 calls that the CARES van has gone to. We've served over 400 individuals via the CARES team. And we have expanded to answering calls citywide. We now have two units. We started with one, and we now have two units. And I think it's been, very successful, both in the sense that there's a clear need. There are calls out there that are getting responded to. On average, calls take about an hour. This is a pretty intensive service. I think we're seeing pretty good outcomes. It's still relatively early, but we are tracking all of the data. And we're trying to, make sure that the service we're providing is useful to the community and to the individuals involved, of course.
We're talking with Mayor of Madison, Satya Rhodes Conway, about the CARES program, dispatching mental health professionals and paramedics rather than police officers to respond to some nonviolent emergency calls. And Mayor Rhodes Conway, what are you hearing from police about this, who presumably would have been responding to some of these incidences before?
I think the feedback from folks in the city across the board, whether that's folks in our police department or our fire department, the city council, et cetera, has been really positive overall. I mentioned that each call can take up to an hour, some of them more than an hour, but our average call length is an hour. And you think about it, that's a long time. And so previously when we were dispatching a police officer, they might be on that call for an hour or more. And that means that they're not doing something else in our community, focused on reducing gun violence or preventing crime. So it eats up a lot of time. I think that that our police officers are happy to not be having to respond to this type of call, which, although we have great mental health officers that do have training in mental health, not every police officer has that training. And so I think it's really productive for us to dispatch these calls to people who are specifically trained to deal with them and can take the time that's needed.
We'll leave it there. Mayor Rhodes Conway, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
That was Madison Mayor Satya Rhodes Conway. She was with us today to talk about the city's CARES team, a non-law enforcement response program for mental health emergency calls. That program operates citywide in Madison. If there's anything like this in your part of the state, or if you're curious about starting something like that up, let us know. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. We would love to hear about it. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, an investigation into the Southern Baptist Convention recently revealed a history of sexual abuse and cover-ups. A lawyer talks with us about how institutions can be held accountable and change in the future. Also, there's conflict, and then there's high conflict in our personal lives and in our politics. An author explains the idea and how we can start to de-escalate when we disagree with people. All that and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we talk with the author of a new book about the relationship between Midwestern dairy farmers and workers from Mexico, and how they can contradict the anti-immigrant rhetoric in politics. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we learn about the BA5 variant of the coronavirus, which is now the dominant strain of virus in the U.S. and leading to some reinfections. First, anti-immigrant rhetoric has become common for many conservative politicians, like former President Donald Trump. Just this week in Wisconsin, Republican candidate for governor Tim Michaels is in the news for his campaigning against illegal immigration. But while he was on the board of the Wisconsin Transportation Builders Association, that group opposed a bill that would have punished companies who hire undocumented workers. Our next guest says that when you get past political platforms, there's a lot more to the story, especially in Wisconsin. She spent years getting to know the state's farmers and their workers and saw the connections they built as they learned more about what they had in common. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the way undocumented workers are talked about in the United States, in Wisconsin? Do you work with or employ people from Mexico or Central America? Have you come to rely on them? If you're a farmer, does this topic resonate with you? We'd love to hear your story, your perspective on all of this. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Ruth Conniff is the editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner. She was previously editor-in-chief of the Progressive magazine. Her new book is called Milked: How an American Crisis Brought Together Midwestern Dairy Farmers and Mexican Workers. Ruth, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, Ruth, you and your family actually moved to Mexico for about a year, and in some ways that seems like it was kind of the beginning stages of this book. What got you interested in peeling back the layers of this story about Wisconsin farms and their workers?
Well, you know, shortly after Trump took office, my family and I decided we really wanted to get out of the United States, go to another country, for the kids to have a Spanish immersion experience and go to schools in Spanish. And we, after talking to friends, we settled on Oaxaca, Mexico, and we had a wonderful year living there. As we were leaving, there was an article in the Wisconsin State Journal and WPR, it was a Wisconsin Watch story about Mexican farmers who had been doing about 80% of the labor on Wisconsin farms, which is really a startling statistic. Some Central American, but mostly Mexican undocumented immigrants who are propping up our dairy industry. And this family that the article followed had found life was getting really unpleasant, that there were ICE raids, the kids were afraid that their parents were going to be snatched off the street and taken away forever. And people were getting, there was more anti-immigrant rhetoric, they felt uncomfortable. So they decided to go back home to Mexico, and they packed up their truck and they drove all the way back to Veracruz. So I read that story just as we were leaving, and I contacted the reporter, Alex Hall, who put me in touch with her sources. And I went down to that little village in the mountains and I met that family. Their truck was still on the street that they had driven all the way back from Wisconsin. And I learned about how it was for them to reintegrate into Mexico after being up here for decades. Their two little boys had grown up in Wisconsin. And when I saw them, they had just started school in the fall, and the other kids were making fun of them for speaking Spanish with a Wisconsin accent. And it was just a really fascinating little glimpse of something that is a major economic reality and has been for decades here in Wisconsin, that our dairy industry is heavily, heavily reliant on undocumented immigrants. And many of them are from Mexico, and many of them have a dream, not an American dream so much as a dream of going back. They're building homes and starting businesses back home. And after working here for many, many years, they plan to return. And so I just got very interested in that topic, learned more and more about it, connected with a wonderful Spanish teacher from Alma, Wisconsin, named Sean Duval, who had served as a translator on the farms and had this brainchild that she should take the farmers to Mexico to try to learn Spanish. And that evolved into an annual trip where they go and visit the families of their workers. So I went on one of those trips when we came back from our year in Oaxaca, and just got really interested in telling the stories of these people, the farmers on this side of the border and the workers who came from the other side of the border, and really how their lives became intertwined, how they became so interdependent, and how contrary that is to the rhetoric, the anti-immigration rhetoric that you hear from the Republican Party. Most of the farmers that I interviewed are Republicans, and yet are totally admiring of the undocumented workers who they depend on.
In some ways, the economic reality that we're in right now in the dairy industry started back in the 1990s with the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement. And it seemed like that sort of created a need on both the Wisconsin farm side and the Mexican family side. Can you talk about the reality that brought about?
Yeah. So, I mean, NAFTA accelerated something that was already happening, which is a trend that's been summed up by both Trump and Nixon's agriculture secretaries as get big or get out. And so farmers in Wisconsin, where we have sustained smaller family dairies for many, many generations, are under a huge amount of pressure to grow, to keep up with low milk prices, food that's traded as a commodity on the global market, not, sort of sourced and processed locally and marketed locally. And NAFTA accelerated that trend. So farmers found themselves in the mid-90s and early 2000s in a position where they were suddenly trying to grow their operations from family-only run small farms, where really mostly just relatives had worked on the farm, to bigger, going from 50 cows to 100, 200, 300 cows, and looking to hire people for the first time. And they found it very hard to hire American workers. So what happened, and I trace this story in my book, is that some Mexican workers who had been doing seasonal labor on Christmas tree farms were attracted to the idea of full-time year-round employment on the dairy farms in Wisconsin, and they started moving over. And through word of mouth and family connections, those Mexican workers and those dairy farms who hired them built a long-term relationship with other relatives and members of Mexican communities coming up to fill those jobs, until we got to this startling 80% statistic with the workers who are milking the cows and shoveling manure and fixing equipment and working long hours, really mostly being undocumented immigrants.
We're talking with Ruth Conniff right now, author of the new book, Milked, How an American Crisis Brought Together Midwestern Dairy Farmers and Mexican Workers. And Ruth, you mentioned that a lot of those workers transitioned to doing year-round jobs in Wisconsin. That had a big impact for their ability to be here legally and their ability to see their families. Can you talk about the reality for them when they chose that year-round work?
Yeah, so this is the thing. There is no visa for year-round low-skilled work in the United States. You can't come here and do farm work year-round legally. And that's why almost all of the workers on Wisconsin dairy farms are undocumented, because they don't have the opportunity to get a visa that makes their work legal. And that's not true in seasonal work in agriculture, because under the Bracero program, which was started in World War II in this country, there is a system for bringing in seasonal workers from Mexico who spend some time harvesting crops and go back home. Not true for dairy.
And another, I want to meet some of the farmers here in Wisconsin that you spent time with, got to know, traveled back and forth to Mexico with. One is John Rosenau. He is a central figure in your book, and he has built up quite a relationship with his employees, including Roberto and Fermin. Can you talk a bit about John, his operation, and some of his workers?
Well, John lives in Wamandy, Wisconsin, and he is really particularly interesting because he's willing to talk about the fact that he employs undocumented people, which is taking a bit of a risk. But I think he feels it's very important to work against the rhetoric that really demonizes undocumented workers. And he has this relationship that is really beautiful. And I found in the book what I discovered in talking to John and spending a bunch of time with him, traveling to Mexico with him, is that he sees the wave of Mexican workers coming to Western Wisconsin as very much like his family that came over here from Germany and Switzerland. And that this next wave of immigrants, in his view, is picking up the same kind of agrarian tradition that his family brought with them to the Wamandy Valley. And so it's an interesting long-term historical perspective. It's sort of a reminder that, you know, we are immigrants in Wisconsin. A lot of people who consider themselves, you know, multi-generation Wisconsinites, their relatives came from somewhere else, just like these Mexican workers. And he has this very interesting plan. He doesn't have kids, and he wants to set up an employee ownership scheme to hand off his farm to these workers when he retires, which is coming up soon. So that idea that they would really take over and continue and be the next generation is, you know, it's touching and it's interesting. He also was just wowed when he went to Mexico and saw the businesses and homes that his former workers who've gone back have built and how entrepreneurial they are. You know, that sort of sense of connection that he describes as it's an agrarian sensibility, and that most people in the United States nowadays would not ever do this kind of farm work. They'd take public assistance before they would do farm work, he said. But not these Mexican workers. And so that sense of connection, like they have similar values as hardworking people and an agrarian sensibility, I found very interesting.
We're talking with Ruth Conniff right now, editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner, author of the new book, Milked, How an American Crisis Brought Together Midwestern Dairy Farmers and Mexican Workers. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does this story, this topic resonate with your life? What would you like to see change with our food system, our immigration policy? If you're a farmer yourself, have workers from Mexico become a crucial part of your operation? What questions do you have for our guest about her work putting this book together and telling the story? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our conversation with Ruth Conniff, author of the new book, Milked, How an American Crisis Brought Together Midwestern Dairy Farmers and Mexican Workers. We're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234, and let's go to the phones right now. We have Pat with us in Green Bay. Hi, Pat.
Greetings.
What did you want to bring up, Pat?
I appreciate this conversation. My employer, this is not a dairy industry, it's not a farming industry, nothing, but my employer has different times of the year, several hundred Central American employees. And for the most part, they are a very hard-working group of people. Other than not being able to understand about 80% of what gets said, but that's life. But why can't it be made so that these people don't have to lie and cheat and everything else to get into this country to work? I mean, there's a real simple solution. You want to work? Here's a card. It's chipped so that they know where you're at. And you pay your taxes just like everybody else. And you can say, if you want to send your money home, go for it.
Pat, thanks for the call. Ruth, Pat asking why there can't be a simpler solution to have people here legally. Did you hear a similar concern from any of the farmers you talked with?
Oh, for sure. I mean, and there can be a simple solution. I mean, it wouldn't be that hard to create an agricultural visa for year-round work. The problem is that immigration reform has gotten so hung up on politics. And I was glad that you started the program by talking about Tim Michaels and the news this week that even though he talks about building the border wall, the prototype for Trump's border wall, and we have to keep illegals out of our country and we can't give them driver's licenses or, you know, help with college tuition. Well, when he was the president of the Road Builders Lobbyist Group, his group helped kill a bill that would punish employers for hiring undocumented workers by taking away government contracts. So, you know, people in the construction industry are heavily reliant on undocumented workers, just like agriculture, just like food service, just like hospitality. So there's a real dishonesty about that anti-immigrant rhetoric, I think, from folks like Michaels, because although he says that he didn't know that his group was lobbying for that bill, I find that a little hard to believe. The position of employers on this issue is, we need these people. And that's what the farmers told me. We need these people. It's a done deal. This has been going on for decades. The level of dependence on these workers is just so great. There's not a solution in terms of hiring American workers instead. So the solution really is, how do we acknowledge the economic reality legally? And there was this great moment in 2013, 2014, when it seemed like Congress was going to pass comprehensive immigration reform. It was blocked by John Boehner, then Speaker of the House, and our own Paul Ryan. And since then, they've never been able to put that bipartisan coalition back together to pass a real fix. And that's a shame. And I think the political rhetoric that's so heated about immigrants as, you know, a threat and a danger and enemies who are coming to take our jobs, even though we know in Wisconsin that that's not true, it has a real dampening effect on the prospect for that reform. So it's a shame because it's a missed opportunity to do something constructive.
And a lot of the farmers you talked with, especially after traveling to Mexico, really grew a bond with their workers, a respect for them, recognized the need for them, cared about them and their families. At the same time, many of the farmers you worked with voted for President Donald Trump twice, who famously accused Mexico of sending in murderers and rapists, wanted to build the border wall. That's complicated. How did they kind of reconcile those two positions?
Well, I think the way that people reconciled supporting Trump, even though they didn't like what he said about immigrants, is that they just tuned out the part they didn't like. And I think the appeal of Trump to a lot of folks, especially in Wisconsin, the number one state for farm bankruptcy in the country, is that he promised to shake up the whole system. And rural people felt that no one was looking out for them and that they weren't getting help from the Democrats or the Republicans, and Trump was an outsider who was going to fix things. And so that the explanation that I got from people was really a combination of saying, well, I hate when he says those things. I think they should take away his Twitter. You know, sort of not wanting to listen to him on the immigrant bashing, but really hoping that something would structurally change in Washington, which it really does have to in order to save family farms.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Kevin in Gilman with us. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. See, I just wanted to make a comment. You know, I'm I've been in the dairy family for, you know, since probably about the early 1800s in Wisconsin. And, you know, we transition over to organic. So we have to meet a lot of USDA rules, just incredible amount of rules. And part of that is our integrity. And we don't hire any illegal migrant workers. And we don't have anything against migrant workers. But what I want to point out is there are a lot of farmers that do milk their own cows, and that a lot of the change that happened in dairy is because of corporate influence, just pushing small family farms out. And it's really kind of abusing both sides. And to me, if these large corporate farms would actually sell or donate land to, you know, the migrant workers to have their own farm, that to me is being a true citizen.
Kevin, thank you for the call. Ruth, Kevin speaking to the, I think, consolidation of the dairy industry, which has kind of led to the need for more workers. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, of course, he's absolutely right. He knows what he's talking about. I mean, it is massive consolidation, vertical integration in the dairy industry. These huge farms, there's now the 30,000 cow farm in Green Bay that's been the subject of a lot of dispute about water quality. But we have giant farms, and we no longer drive through the Wisconsin countryside and see a lot of grazing cows. And that's tragic. It's that trend has a lot of ill effects for a lot of people, not just for farmers who in Wisconsin have suffered tremendously. We were losing 2 farms a day in 2018, it's down to 1 farm a day. The fact that Sonny Perdue, Trump's ag secretary, would come here and say, well, the big get bigger and the small go out, it's just incredibly insensitive to the tragedy of the loss of those farms. So I absolutely agree. Something needs to be done on a bigger picture level. And it's pretty intense to think that the solution is for people to smuggle themselves across the border in the trunk of a car, as some of the people I talked to did, and do these jobs, keep their heads down for a couple of decades and then go home where they've built a home and maybe left their family and haven't seen them for years and years. I mean, there's not really an argument that this is a great system, but it is the system that we have in Wisconsin. So I think we have to look at the fact that while some people have been able to hang on with smaller farms, and certainly Organic Valley is a tremendous success story, the great majority of farms are having to grow in order to survive. And it doesn't, demonizing undocumented workers or somehow blaming them for that doesn't make any sense. And we need to think about what would make a more humane and livable life for both groups of rural people in Mexico and the United States. And I get into that a little bit in my book, sort of how the smaller scale village life in Mexico looked so appealing to Wisconsin farmers who felt like it was similar to how their lives looked back in the 1960s, with neighbors helping neighbors and family operations and, you know, the idea that you could live a more humane scale, livable life, better for people and animals and land, and just happier, it's tremendously appealing and kind of nostalgic and kind of poignant, because you see rural people on both sides of the border losing that and on a treadmill to make money and survive that is making life harder and less pleasant for everyone.
Well, Ruth, thank you for sharing this with us today. Thanks for taking the time. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Ruth Conniff is editor-in-chief of the Wisconsin Examiner. We talked with her today about her new book called Milked: How an American Crisis Brought Together Midwestern Dairy Farmers and Mexican Workers. You can catch Ruth doing a reading from the book in Madison at A Room of One's Own bookstore next Tuesday, July 19th at 6 o'clock p.m. Coming up after the news, a public health expert explains the BA.5 variant of the coronavirus, which has been shown to evade prior immunity better than previous variants and lead to some cases of reinfection. I'm Rob Ferret, or Dean Kinetter, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.